This text outlines the Life Coherence Arbitration Protocol, a methodological casebook for navigating tragic choices between urgent human survival needs and the preservation of ecological or indigenous life grounds.
Integrating the plain language translations directly into the core methodological steps will significantly increase the practical utility of this casebook for on-the-ground decision makers.
Right, because, I mean, the author's integration of McMurtry, Maturana, and Galting is rigorous, and the case study is a brilliant stress test, but the practical impact is what we need to look at.
Exactly. The stated goal here is to be a practical companion casebook to guide real-world judgment under, you know, immediate constraint.
Yeah, but then you dive into the main narrative of the arbitration steps, and the language just creates this immense cognitive load.
It really does. Heavy academic terminology totally dominates the main narrative.
Like, we hit phrases like autopoetic structural coupling and money sequence disvalue.
Right.
While supposedly trying to figure out how to mediate a land dispute during a flood. I can follow the theory, but if I'm a humanitarian coordinator in a makeshift command center, I don't have the bandwidth for that.
No, you don't. Let's actually unpack those terms for a second, just to see what the document is demanding of its reader.
Yeah, let's do that.
So when the text brings in autopoietic structural coupling, it's drawing on Humberto Mazzarana's biological systems theory.
Which is this beautiful concept about how living systems, like a forest or a community, self-create and adapt to survive.
Exactly. And then money sequence disvalue is from the philosopher John McMurtry, referring to how our economic systems prioritize profit loops over actual life-sustaining necessities.
Which are both, you know, crucial concepts for understanding why these ecological and indigenous life grounds are under threat in the first place.
Absolutely. But the issue is where those concepts are placed in relation to the people actually using the protocol.
Because currently, the plain language translations are completely separated from the core steps.
Yes. The actual questions a mediator would ask a community to figure out those life needs are entirely relegated to Appendix B.
Ah, man, they're literally 30 pages away from the core steps.
Right. It creates an unnecessary barrier for the humanitarians, coordinators, or local administrators who most need this tool.
I can see what you're going for here. Let's see how we can strengthen this. By bringing the user manual out of the appendix and onto the front panel, do we risk losing the theoretical rigor, or does it actually prove the theory's real-world strength?
Oh, I would argue the exact opposite of losing rigor. It proves the theory's real-world strength.
Like, it's currently a highly advanced piece of medical equipment that requires a PhD to operate.
Exactly. We should weave the community-facing questions from that translation guide directly into the narrative of the eight steps.
So the reader experiences the translation in real time alongside the theoretical concepts.
Yes. Let's look at step 5.2, mapping affected life capacities. Right now, the prose just states that autopoietic life remains viable.
Which doesn't help much if you're holding a clipboard in a town hall meeting.
Not at all. So rather than just stating that, immediately pair it in the main prose with the Appendix B question.
So you just write, what must stay intact for people, communities, or ecosystems to remain whole?
Exactly. You state the goal of viability, and right in the next sentence, you drop that plain language question.
You're collapsing the distance between the philosopher's desk and the field worker.
Yeah. And think about step 5.7, which requires participatory languaging. Currently, it tells the reader to establish a threshold of irreversibility.
Again, a really strong concept, but kind of opaque.
Right. But Appendix B has this fantastic two-column table translating those terms.
Oh, so you just directly embed that two-column table from the appendix into the core text of step 5.7?
Precisely. Explicitly show how to translate threshold of irreversibility into what damage could not be undone during a community forum.
That makes so much sense. But this also ties into Galting's theories of violence, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Galting's concept of cultural violence warns us about language systems that exclude marginalized groups.
Right. So if an indigenous community has to understand the academic phrase epistemic colonization just to participate,
then the protocol is accidentally reproducing the very exclusion it's trying to dismantle.
Wow. So keeping the plain language in the appendix is actually a form of hierarchy?
Which brings us to how this document handles power in general. Repositioning the anti-coercion safeguards to precede the eight-step protocol will establish the necessary boundaries of power before the reader attempts to navigate the arbitration exercise.
Okay, so we're talking about section 6 here, the structural rules.
Right. Section 6 introduces vital structural rules, such as emergency power must expire and repair must be funded before harm proceeds, only after the reader has already mentally walked through the entire 8-step arbitration process in Section 5.
They're tucked away at the very end.
Yeah. Placing these safeguards at the end makes them feel like a postscript or an afterthought rather than the foundational prerequisites required to prevent the protocol from being weaponized.
So a key theme running through this material seems to be urgency versus constraint.
Absolutely.
If we place the safeguards before the step-by-step action, is there a risk of slowing down the momentum of the tragic choice case study? How do we balance narrative urgency with these necessary boundaries?
That's clearly laid out. I wonder, though, if we've considered that without those boundaries established first, the urgency of the case study actually invites the very administrative expediency the author is trying to dismantle.
Ah, like the fire extinguisher mentality during a crisis.
Exactly. When you give a decision maker a tool for rapid arbitration during a flood, their default instinct is to use it to clear administrative hurdles as fast as possible.
And that's exactly how indigenous life grounds get bulldozed in the name of emergency shelter.
Right. That's why we have to invert the sequence of these sections. Move Section 6, the anti-coercion safeguards, to become the new Section 5.
So you present the anti-coercion safeguards as the architecture of legitimacy that has to be constructed first.
Yes. It must be constructed before the 8 steps of arbitration can safely be executed.
But how do we link them so it doesn't just read like a disconnected list of rules?
We explicitly link the safeguards to the steps. For instance, Safeguard 6.7 states that the implementing authority cannot be the sole evaluator.
Okay.
You explicitly link that as the foundational reason why Step 5.7, participatory languaging, is non-negotiable.
Because you can't be the sole evaluator if you're the only one who speaks the bureaucratic language. That's brilliant.
Yeah. And look at Safeguard 6.8, which says repair must be funded before harm proceeds.
Which is huge, because in disaster response, the repair phase is almost always abandoned once the cameras leave.
Exactly. So frame Safeguard 6.8 as the prerequisite gateway into Step 5.8, which is monitor, repair, and revise.
So if you don't lock down the funding first, you can't even enter Step 5.8. You're just doing performative monitoring.
Precisely. It builds the cage before you put the lion inside.
I love that. And once those rules governing power are firmly established, it naturally leads to looking at how that power operates in reality.
Which means looking at the state actors, expanding the depiction of the governance system in the central case study to include interagency conflict will prove the protocol's power to dismantle entrenched bureaucratic silos.
Because right now, the central case does a great job detailing the competing needs of the displaced families, the indigenous communities, and the forest ecosystem.
It does. But it treats the governance system somewhat monolithically.
Yeah, it defines the government's needs simply as legitimacy, trust, and coordination.
Which overlooks the reality that during emergencies, the state itself is often deeply fractured. And that is exactly where tragic choices usually stall.
As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is that the state isn't a monolith, but more like a multi-headed hydra pulling in different directions. By making the governance system just as fractured as the external conflict, the stress test of the protocol becomes incredibly authentic.
That's spot on. You have to introduce competing state agencies into the tragic choice scenario.
So how do we do that without making the case study too bloated?
In Section 4, the central case, explicitly divide the government actor into competing factions.
Give me an example.
So pit the Emergency Management Agency against the Ministry of Environment.
Ah, okay. And the Emergency Management Agency has a legal mandate focused solely on rapid shelter deployment to minimize mortality.
Right, their metric is tents deployed per hour.
But then you have the Ministry of Environment, whose legal mandate is preventing old growth fragmentation.
And their metric is like soil erosion rates and watershed integrity.
Exactly. Neither agency is acting out of malice, but they are structurally blind to each other's mandate.
And then you show how the protocol handles that internal friction.
Yes, show how the non-reductionist evidence dashboard in Section 7 forces these siloed agencies to reconcile their incompatible metrics.
Because the dashboard makes the emergency agency look at the watershed function red lines.
Yeah, and it forces the Environment Ministry to look at the health and trauma metrics of the displaced families.
Oh, that's fantastic. By forging compossible solutions across a fragmented government, you prove the tool actually works in the messy reality of disaster response. Exactly.
Exactly. It elevates the whole text.
All right, well, let's briefly recap the three core actionable suggestions we've explored today.
Sounds good. First, we talked about embedding the plain language translation guide directly into the 8 methodological steps.
Right, bringing it out of Appendix B.
Second, reordering the paper to place the anti-coercion safeguards before the protocol to establish boundaries of power.
Setting up that architecture of legitimacy first.
And third, introducing interagency friction into the case study to demonstrate the framework's ability to resolve bureaucratic silos.
Yeah, I sincerely want to thank the listener for submitting such a rigorous, vital piece of work. The conceptual foundation here is incredibly strong.
It really is.
And by making these structural and narrative shifts, you ensure this methodology can be utilized by those making the hardest decisions on the ground.
We warmly invite the listener to implement this feedback and submit their revised work back to the critique for further exploration. Thanks for joining us.